Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And we begin on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Yes, They Are Into Real Estate. With a vast portfolio of real estate holdings, Triangle Universities draw up plans to monetize assets. And that's the headline on the front page inside of the Triangle Business Journal. The article begins with another headline, Cash Rolls Off Campus. And this article is written by Jennifer Henderson. Whether Triangle students opt to backpack through the Brickyard at NC State University, frequent Franklin Street in Chapel Hill, or pass by Duke Chapel, they're surrounded by a sprawling campus. But leaders at NCSU, UNC Chapel Hill, and Duke University are thinking beyond the lecture halls and libraries on their ever-growing main campuses. Sitting on real estate worth billions of dollars, university administrators are charting plans that continue to extend their influence beyond the traditional walls of learning. Real estate development and investment is being discussed among deans, chancellors, and boards of governors as a source of income and way to further connect the universities to their communities. And it's a source of income that could help offset any cuts in public funding, lethargic endowment returns, and any future impacts from online learning. The three major universities in the Triangle have been busier with real estate projects than they are now. I've never been busier. NCSU has major plans to expand Centennial Campus in Raleigh. UNC Chapel Hill has teamed up with developers on the massive Carolina Square project on Franklin Street. And dollars flowing from Duke are a major driver of Durham's growth. Universities want to help create communities, says Scott Selig, Duke's Associate Vice President of Capital Assets and Real Estate. Duke has been very active in helping to recreate a vibrant community in downtown Durham. Lure to build mixed-use projects. NCSU, UNC Chapel Hill, and Duke all realize the attractiveness of mixed-use developments, and they have all incorporated this real estate trend in varying ways. For NCSU, Centennial Campus is where it's at. Urban development has shifted to live-work-play models over the last 10 years, says Jeff Bandini, Associate Vice Chancellor of Real Estate and Development at NCSU. For technologies that originate from the university, bringing companies back to space on Centennial Campus is one goal in line with the university's mission, according to Bandini, as well as supporting the local, regional, and state economy. Both startups and more established firms are attracted to calling mixed-use developments home, he says. According to NCSU, it has more than 70 community partners that are corporate, government, or nonprofit partners, and more than 75 that are NC State research centers, institutes, laboratories, and department units. Centennial Campus is also home to condominiums, apartments, and student housing, and NCSU wants to grow that even more. The goal of Centennial Campus is to develop a community with a complementary mix of academic and corporate ventures, plus residences that are footsteps from work, school, and everything in between. Centennial Campus opened in 1989 and has evolved into a national model. Bandini says schools from across the U.S. have continued to visit Centennial Campus as a guide for their own mixed-use ventures. Most recently, the officials from the University of New Hampshire spent several days at the campus. 30 miles away, UNC Chapel Hill is getting more involved in office retail and living projects in a way that is giving Franklin Street a facelift. The university's Carolina Square project, developed in partnership with Cousins Properties and Northwood Raven, will incorporate office, retail, and apartments, including massive mainstream tenant Target. Gordon Merkline, Associate Vice Chancellor of University Real Estate Operations, says Carolina Square adds to the vitality of Chapel Hill. The university will also reap an economic return from Carolina Square, but Merkline says the university would not go out and buy property for economic return if it did not meet some existing or future mission of the university. So far, the increased involvement from the universities in the real estate game has not been seen as a threat to those already in the industry. Lee Perry, development director of Chapel Hill-based East-West Partners, says he doesn't view universities as active competition. We've never run across them actually pursuing a site that they didn't own, he says. At the same time, he noted that universities' longer-term horizons and lower return expectations would prove beneficial in competition with private developers. The increased activity by universities has helped developers in key ways. In Durham, for example, Duke has recently gobbled up sizable leased space at downtown's revitalized Chesterfield manufacturing plant. And the Durham Innovation District project, which is currently being developed to include both office and retail. While Duke's Selig says he expects Duke to continue to be a strong catalyst for the renovation of downtown, he notes that downtown Durham is about 99% leased. Real estate, part of strategic plan. The strategic look at real estate is a way for Triangle Universities to plan for an evolving future. For NCSU, real estate is in the university's DNA, says Bandini. The school was founded as a land-grant university in 1887, scooping up federal land under the Morrill Act and focusing on areas such as agriculture and military science. But it hasn't been until recently that it hunkered down on a long-term strategy for its centennial campus. Over the last year or so, NCSU has started developing 5, 10, and 30-year plans for Centennial Campus in particular, and its Centennial Biomedical Campus, according to Bandini. One goal is to focus more on private development in terms of Centennial Campus, he says. He adds that there is an opportunity for us to generate revenue to support academic and research objectives. In terms of the university's real estate more generally, NCSU has also been honing in on treating its portfolio as an asset, according to Bandini. He says the university is looking at opportunities to monetize land it already holds. NCSU states that it has about $2.16 billion value in buildings under its capital assets as of 2015, up almost $160 million from the year before. The university also owns $39.33 million in land as of 2015, the value of which has gone up from the year before. The university owns 2,955 acres of land in Wake County and 104,854 acres in North Carolina, according to Bandini. UNC Chapel Hill is also taking a hard look at its real estate and its opportunities. Real estate is a regular part of the university's master plan. The plan was updated in 2006 as part of a roughly 10-year review cycle, and a new master plan is currently underway, according to Anna Wu, Associate Vice Chancellor for Facility Services. As of 2015, UNC owned buildings with a total value of $2.94 billion, up marginally from the year before. The university's land portfolio was valued at more than $63 million as of 2015. The school controls and maintains almost 20 million square feet, excluding healthcare facilities, according to a university spokeswoman. The university's master plan will look at areas like major land parcels, as well as natural resources, infrastructure, transportation, among others, Wu says. Part of the goal, she says, is to see how the campus might physically grow over the next 50 years. That could involve thinking creatively about assets the school already has. Many universities are currently looking at repurposing existing square footage to not just rely on new construction, Wu says. At the same time, Wu notes, the return we're seeking on land holdings is different than what a project developer would be looking at. The university is tying return back to its mission, looking at best land use and considering development and conservation, she says. And Merkline says, when we purchase a property, we look at what's the strategic value to the university in meeting its academic mission. Or, he adds, whether it will generate income aimed at going back into that mission. Duke's Selig says the university and the health system look at off-campus real estate long-term, 5, 10, and 20 years out. On average, Duke renegotiates between 50 and 60 leases each year, he says. According to Duke's 2014 Form 990, the university stated $2.95 billion in buildings before accumulated depreciation and $24.54 million in land. The university's 2013 Form 990 states buildings and land at $2.77 billion and $24.64 million, respectively. The university owns roughly 15 million square feet of real estate on and off campus, according to Michael Schoenfeld, a Duke vice president, and 9,000 acres of land on and off campus. Duke University and Health System have done more than $2 billion of construction in the past 10 years, he adds. In terms of the university and the massive Duke Health System, there will be real estate expansion, in particular the healthcare side, Selig says, adding that on the university side, that will depend on grants, funding that has the potential to fluctuate. We're very much looking at trends on a national basis as well as here locally, says Selig. Across town in Durham, North Carolina, North Carolina Central University's 2015 annual report states $331.38 million in buildings under capital assets, depreciable, for the year ended June 30, 2015, roughly the same as the year prior. Under capital assets, non-depreciable, the university states $7.27 million in land as of June 30, 2015, also the same as the year prior. Online plans not a factor yet. The universities are building up their real estate portfolios at a time when students are flocking to more flexible and affordable means of achieving college degrees. The continued rise of online education could impact the way universities approach their real estate empires. For example, will future universities need so much dorm and classroom space if more students learn virtually? But it could be more of a ding than a dent and still a ways off, think decades. According to the most recent data from the National Center for Education Statistics, 4% of undergraduate students at NCSU are enrolled only in distance education, and 35% are enrolled in some distance education. For graduate students, those percentages are 19% and 11%, respectively. According to NCES data at UNC Chapel Hill, 1% of undergraduate students are enrolled only in distance education, and 9% are enrolled in some distance education. 9% of graduate students are enrolled only in distance education, and 6% are enrolled in some distance education. There are no undergraduate students enrolled in distance education at Duke, NCES data shows, but 5% of graduate students are enrolled in only distance education, while 3% are enrolled in some distance education. The absolute number of students enrolled in distance education will go up and down, but not that much, says David Radwin, a senior research associate at RTI International. Another important consideration is how many online courses students are actually taking, Radwin says. NCES data show that nationally the percentage of undergraduate students taking one course is rising from 1999 to 2000, 8%, from 2003 to 2004, 16%, from 2007 to 2008, 20%, and from 2011 to 2012, 32%. The number of undergraduates only enrolled in distance education remains relatively small. From 1999 to 2000, that number was just 2%, and it was still just 6% for 2012. Students at very traditional colleges like Duke or UNC, if they take one class online, that's not really changing their land use patterns and not changing their life in a major way, Radwin says. That scenario is very different than if they enroll in exclusively online courses where they don't have to travel to a particular place. Wu notes a trend toward more online course offerings, but says UNC Chapel Hill has not seen a significant impact on the need for space on campus. At the same time, the university can always look at how it may repurpose space in the future, she says. Of NCSU, Bandini says, we're in a unique situation where real estate and development will always be a central core of what NC State does, as long as we have Centennial Campus. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings. The main headline, who wants to visit Oahu over Raleigh? You might not think of Raleigh as ranking up there as places to visit, along with Bali, Oahu, and Lisbon, but the editors of Forbes Travel Guide sure do. The City of Oaks is on a list of 12 places to visit in 2017, thanks to the city's rising culinary scene. We've screamed of the charms of North Carolina's capital city before, Forbes writes, but now the editors are particularly enthused about the 2016 opening of Crawford & Son in downtown Raleigh and new restaurants on the way this year. The list of places to visit also includes Washington, Los Angeles, Houston, Phoenix, and Santa Barbara, California. But who needs to go there when you have Raleigh, right? Millennials' key demo in bid for MLS franchise. The 40-day sprint to enter the running for a Major League Soccer expansion franchise is close to a major deadline, with the Triangle polishing off its bid that includes a heavy emphasis on the market's hefty millennial population. The North Carolina Football Club, led by owner Steve Malik, announced in December that it would pursue an MLS team, but the timeline is tight. The group received the application materials on Friday, December 23, at 5 p.m., team president Kurt Johnson says. In other words, happy holidays, and we need that by January 31. There are plenty of hurdles. The expansion fee is a staggering $150 million, and the team will need a 24,000-seat stadium. A crowded field of contenders includes a well-financed Charlotte bid. The MLS isn't giving any hints, but you can bet two expansion teams in North Carolina is about as likely as one of the teams signing Ronaldo. But Johnson says the Triangle bid has some strengths. In particular, he says, the bid will focus on the millennial-rich population of the Triangle, the growing Latino population in North Carolina, and the strong support for youth soccer here. Millennials, Johnson says, are a vital demographic for MLS. They've grown up with the game. They have discretionary income, and they are passionate about soccer, he says. The stadium is another key issue. Johnson says MLS prefers a stadium in an urban area with a dense population. That could still mean keeping the team in Cary and upgrading the Wake Med Soccer Park while development builds up in the area. The town of Cary has a vision for that land as a gateway to Cary, he says. Huge gift includes Rembrandts. Rembrandt is taking up residence at UNC Chapel Hill's Ackland Art Museum. On January 25, UNC Chapel Hill announced a whopping gift valued at $25 million that includes 134 pieces of art, including seven by Rembrandt van Rijn. The bulk of the collection is Dutch and Flemish works from the 17th century. The gift comes from Sheldon Peck, a native of Durham who graduated in 1963 and went on to be a prominent orthodontic specialist and educator, and his wife, Lena. The exceptional vision and profound humanity of the Dutch master's drawings still have the power to surprise and delight 400 years after their creation, Peck said. The gift includes funding for Ackland to add staff. Durham Hotel joins ranks of AAA's four Diamond Award winners. The 21C Museum Hotel that opened in Durham in 2015 has joined the ranks of some of the world's most elite hospitality establishments on the AAA's Four Diamond rating list. North Carolina has 45 hotels and restaurants on the Four Diamond Award list for 2017, including nine in the Triangle. Three hotels and two restaurants are listed among AAA's more elite Five Diamond Awards listed in 2017, including the Umstead Hotel and Spa in Cary and Pittsburgh's Farrington House Inn. Goodbye, Tribeca Tavern. The owners of the Tribeca Tavern restaurant and bar have announced plans to close the North Raleigh location on Falls of Neuse Road. An email sent to fans of the restaurant states that Tribeca Hospitality owners Jeff Shank and Bob Frame plan to relocate the restaurant to another address in the Triangle, but the message did not detail where or when. The location at 6004 Falls of Neuse Road in front of the North Ridge Shopping Center will close January 29. And new role for Scavarla. John Scavarla, who led the North Carolina Department of Commerce under Governor Pat McCrory, has a new role. Scavarla landed at the Raleigh office of Nexen Pruitt as Senior Government Relations Advisor. Scavarla will focus on economic development. And now we turn to the On Real Estate page, written by Amanda Hoyle. The main headline, Real Estate Forecast Projects a Strong Year for Triangle, Just Not as Robust. Buyer interest in land sales, home sales, and retail markets in the Triangle will be up in 2017, but activity for apartments, income property transactions, and rental rate increases is expected to taper off, especially in the second half of 2017. That's according to Jimmy Barnes, president of NAI Carroll Atlantic Realty in Raleigh. In his address before a crowd of close to 1,800 people January 19th at the company's 32nd annual real estate conference in PNC Arena. It's going to be another good year, just not as robust, Barnes said. Some of the big takeaways from Barnes' real estate forecast for 2017. Office and industrial markets. The year 2017 will be another big year, Barnes said, noting that close to 3.4 million square feet of new building construction is underway, and that absorption of the new space is expected to keep up with supply. We do expect in-office and in-multipurpose for rental rates to level off, especially in the second half of the year, he says. Retail. Grocery stores have pushed the growth curve for new retail in the Triangle for the past 3 years, and Barnes expects that to continue. Multifamily. In spite of the increase in supply of new apartment units, vacancy for apartments went down to 7% in 2016. Barnes forecasts the apartment development pipeline will slow in 2017 as financial lenders clamp down on new loans for multifamily, but he said he expects absorption to still continue to be strong. He expects healthy rental rates, but not the increase like the last 3 years. Single family. Construction of new single-family housing was up 10% in 2016, and Barnes said he expects much of the same for 2017. There's going to be some high-demand areas where we're going to have some land shortages, and inventories are going to be low, he said. Income properties. Transactional volume was lower in 2016 compared to 2015, and he expects interest from investors in income properties to remain dampened in 2017. With interest rates increasing, not as much demand, we do think prices are going to start to level off, he said. Land. NAI Carroll Atlantic Realty broker Moss Withers chimed in with a video forecast for the land sales market, noting that NAI Carroll Atlantic had closed on the sale of more than 1,000 acres in 2016 with a total transaction value of about $75 million. Trends to watch included renewed interest in land for hotel and offices, plus opportunities for retail and grocery stores. Blue Heron expands focus with new $39 million fund. It has been a busy couple of years for Maurice Malfatti and the team that he and partner Ron Strom have been assembling at Blue Heron Asset Management, a real estate management group that flipped its focus in 2011 to investing capital through pooled investment funds. In addition to moving their corporate office from Chapel Hill to a hip new space at Pilot Mill in downtown Raleigh, they've cashed out of nearly all of the investments made with their first fund, initiated in 2011, the $26 million Blue Heron Real Estate Opportunity Fund I. Malfatti confirms that the firm has closed out fundraising efforts for its second fund, Blue Heron Real Estate Opportunity Fund II, with a total commitment of $39 million from 35 institutional investor groups and high net worth individuals and families. We're taking an opportunistic strategy, he says. In Fund One, Blue Heron had five real estate investments, all in the Triangle, highlighted by the $30 million Village at Marquee Station in Fuquay Varina that Blue Heron helped finance and developed. It sold the property in 2016 for $41.5 million. For Fund Two, Blue Heron is spreading its wings with acquisitions so far already in Charlotte, Nashville, Tennessee, and Frederick, Maryland, as well as Raleigh and Durham. Fund II's portfolio so far includes the 55-unit historic Boylan Apartments near downtown Raleigh with plans for renovations. Wegmans a step closer to reality in Chapel Hill. Developers of the proposed Wegmans in Chapel Hill have secured the land and the construction loan to begin demolition and site work for the big new grocery building later this year. Texas-based Leon Capital Group on January 23 closed on the purchase of Hendrick Automotive's Performance Auto Mall properties on Fordham Boulevard, paying $11.9 million for the 13-acre site, according to Orange County Records. The developer also bought for $1.34 million two small buildings on Old Durham Road that'll be needed for overflow parking. Hendrick Automotive plans to relocate its Acura, BMW, and Subaru dealerships in Chapel Hill to the Durham South Point Auto Mall near the streets at South Point Mall. Chapel Hill and Orange County government leaders in October approved an economic development incentive package for Wegmans worth $4 million. And in a section called He Said It, the quote, I don't think there's any question in either of the proposals we're discussing tonight whether they will increase our property values. It's indubitable. The question is, will our quality of life be what we have to pay in return for that property value? And that's from Will Yudusky, member of Midtown Citizens Advisory Council, who voted January 23 to endorse two separate rezoning applications by Raleigh developers John Kane and Todd Said. The plans on St. Albans Drive include properties of up to 20 stories. And finally, a section called Luxury Homes. The Triangle's luxury home market in 2016 was all about new construction. Based on a review of deed records and Triangle MLS listings, the Triangle region had 17 home sales that were valued at $1.8 million or more in 2016, down from a market high of 22 sales in 2015. Of those 17, 11 were new homes built by custom home builders in the market. We have a lot of buyers in the Triangle area looking at the $1.5 million and up price point, says Julian Jahu of Fonville Morrissey Realty in Durham, who represented the sellers of three of the luxury homes on the list for 2016. And now we turn to the On Tech and Transportation page written by Lauren Onasorge. The main headline, Triangle to test out driverless vehicles. A rally by the state of North Carolina will soon bring an autonomous vehicle testing pilot program to the Triangle, a data-heavy research project that could include the complete 540 project. The U.S. Department of Transportation has selected the North Carolina Turnpike Authority as one of 10 test locations for self-driving car technology. The technology is already out there, says Bo Memory, executive director of the NCTA. We thought this was an opportunity to be on the forefront of that. Few details about the project are available, from when the research will start to what will be trekking across the highway, but authorities know that the Triangle Expressway, a highway that sees nearly 50,000 cars on an average weekday, will be the testing ground. Whatever opportunities come, they will be completely discretionary, he says, adding that NCDOT won't do anything to put drivers in danger. The Triangle Expressway is the one facility we have open to traffic. We generate mounds of data on what's happening at that facility, and this is the opportunity to get ahead of the technology. Anything we can learn to make our road the safest in the region, that's what we're going to take away from this. The state included several reasons in its application to USDOT as to why North Carolina should be included in the project. In addition to the state's intelligent transportation system, a fiber-backed communication network that allows the NCTA to maintain, operate, monitor, and study the Triangle Expressway, officials cited upcoming construction such as the extension and the complete 540 project. A new highway would allow opportunities to test the technology on newly opened roadways and interchanges. The first phase, cited in NCDOT's proposal, is scheduling a construction contract award in 2018. Over the past several weeks, that project timeline has changed, however, pushing the next extension to 2020. It's a discrepancy that's not lost on Joe Malazzo, executive director of the Regional Transportation Alliance. In addition to partnering with NCDOT on the proposal, Malazzo's group is campaigning for the acceleration of that 540 project timeline. He calls construction of the southern extension of that highway priority one for his group. The pilot program is another point to bolster the argument. We are hopeful that the project will be accelerated, he says. Memory says any impacts on construction timelines have yet to be determined. In the meantime, work on two additional interchanges along the Triangle Expressway at Old Holly Springs Apex Road and Morrisville Parkway could serve the same purpose. Sauce changes name, finds a path to aisles of major stores. Raleigh sauce entrepreneur Neil Nello McTighe has taken a big pivot when it comes to his Nello's sauce brand. And it's about to be visible on more shelves as a new manufacturing deal has helped secure large contracts with retailers such as Harris Teeter and Earth Fare. After a cease and desist letter from a similarly named restaurant, he has changed Nello's sauce to Nellino's sauce. Nello had been McTighe's nickname since 1998, and shifting the name took an emotional toll, he says. But after a three-month redesign process, some of his corporate partners actually like the new brand better, he says. Among the new brand's fans is Harris Teeter, which just inked a deal to put McTighe's products in the pasta sauce aisles of all of its 245 locations. It's a relationship McTighe has been cultivating for nearly 5 years, and it has been limited in the past by distribution. When you hand make your batches, you're limited in what you can sell, he explains. That's why the sauce started in just a handful of Harris Teeter stores years ago, limited to the local aisle. In February, however, three flavors will launch throughout the chain. A new manufacturing agreement he enters into in February is driving the move. He's sparse on the details, but says there are virtually no capacity limits through his new out-of-state partner. It's just what he's willing to pay. And that's why McTighe sought out a new partner, so that if another retail giant comes up with a mass order for jars, he can accommodate on the capacity front. So far, SunTrust Bank has proved to be the only financial partner he needs to fulfill mass orders. If a Walmart came calling, he'd have to seek out an additional credit line, he says. He is not seeking venture capital. Pasta sauce is not an exit business, McTighe says. Historically, there's not a lot of people starting out in pasta sauce and 10 years later selling, he says. It tends to be family-owned, and I really want my son, if he's interested, I'd love to pass it on to him. Exec, digital driving, Wells Fargo cuts. Speaking weeks after Wells Fargo disclosed plans to close more than 400 branches nationwide through 2018, Jack Clayton, regional president of the San Francisco-based bank, says his team isn't nervous about the number issued by corporate. Every year I've always looked at the branches that are duplicative, he says, calling it routine. He blames digitization for the move, not a cost savings effort associated with Wells Fargo's recent reputation hit. It came to light last year that Wells Fargo employees had opened up to 2 million accounts without customers' permission to meet aggressive sales goals. As a result, Wells Fargo is shelling out $185 million in penalties and changing its compensation program. And in a section called He Said It, you can't afford a lengthy search for a successor if something happens. The best place to start is within. And that's from Peter Gwaltney, CEO of the North Carolina Bankers Association, talking about the importance of having a succession plan. And also we have a section called By the Numbers. Raleigh-based First Citizens Bank grew its loan portfolio in 2016 by $1.5 billion. The growth in 2016 came as First Citizens acquired the $348 million asset Cordia Bancorp, the parent of Bank of Virginia. Overall, First Citizens reported $28.2 billion in deposits at the end of December, crediting growth in checking with interest accounts and money market accounts. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Life Sciences page written by Jennifer Henderson. The main headline, Argos grabs NCSU space in cancer fight. A growing Triangle company plans to base a key part of its fight against kidney cancer out of NC State University's Centennial Campus. With a new 40,000-square-foot lease for manufacturing space on Centennial Campus, Durham-based Argos Therapeutics is prepping for commercialization as early as next year, President and CEO Jeff Abbey says. Argos is developing immunotherapies for the treatment of cancer and infectious diseases. Its Centennial Campus space was selected for the future commercialization of its most advanced product candidate, Rocapodensyl T, for the treatment of metastatic renal cell carcinoma or the spread of kidney cancer. The National Cancer Institute says that in 2013, there were nearly 400,000 people in the United States with kidney and renal pelvis cancer. The company is anticipating U.S. Food and Drug Administration approval before the end of 2018, and with that comes the need for ramped up manufacturing. We think we've got a manufacturing strategy that meets our growth in a cost-effective way, Abby says. The new space marks Argos's fourth facility. Abby says that, ahead of commercialization, the company will add about 70 jobs. The Centennial Campus space will be built out and up and running by the end of the year, he says, adding it will be able to meet a capacity of as many as 2,400 patients per year. In the meantime, Argos also has a long-term lease on an even larger manufacturing facility on TW Alexander Drive in Durham that it plans to expand following FDA approval. That facility will be able to meet a capacity of 10,000 patients per year, according to Abby. Argos currently manufactures from its facility at 4233 Technology Drive in Durham, and it also has a research and development facility on Miami Boulevard, Abby says. In the near term, Argos will continue to manufacture for clinical trials out of its Technology Drive location, he says, adding that at some point the company may not need all of its current facilities. The company's headcount is currently about 130 people, according to Abby. We would expect to be at least 200 people by the end of this year, he says. Over the course of 2017, Argos expects to hire in areas like manufacturing and quality assurance and to begin to put together a commercial team, Abby says. Parata Systems moving to new headquarters in Durham. Durham-based pharmacy technology company Parata Systems has landed a new headquarters at 106 Roach Drive, part of Alexander Industrial Park, which will consolidate all of its functions into a single space. The company will move into its new space later this year. The company currently has two locations in Durham, 2600 Meridian Parkway, which serves as the company's headquarters and houses functions like engineering and sales, and 3751 South Alston Avenue, where manufacturing is located, according to Graham Schillmoller, vice president of Parata's finance and operations. Our primary motivation was to get everybody under one roof, says Schillmoller, also noting the new headquarters will aid in achieving significant operational efficiencies and serve as a showcase for our customers. Executives depart MERS in Raleigh. About 18 months after MERS North America moved its headquarters from Greensboro to Raleigh, the company is operating with an interim CEO. In recent months, Bill Humphreys, the CEO, and his deputy, Michael McMine, have departed the company. Humphreys landed at Valiant Pharmaceuticals International, which has seen troubles in the wake of its recent acquisitions of Triangle-based Salix Pharmaceuticals and Sprout Pharmaceuticals. Back in 2014, MERS announced that its move to Raleigh, which was selected minus any incentives, would result in 50 new jobs. We recently celebrated our second anniversary in Raleigh and look forward to continuing to strengthen our presence in the community, a company spokeswoman said. There are approximately 250 Raleigh employees, which is a substantial increase from the number of employees in Greensboro. Growing BioVentus hires new executive. A Durham-based company experiencing growth abroad has hired a new executive to help in that regard. BioVentus has named John Nocenzo, who had been Senior Vice President of Global Customer Operations at Beckman Coulter Diagnostics, as its Chief Commercial Officer. The company announced January 23. It's a new position for BioVentus. Just last week, BioVentus announced a Russian distribution deal for Durolane, a single injection product for the treatment of osteoarthritis pain. BioVentus CEO Tony Bill said Nocenzo will help the company fully capture the global market potential for BioVentus's expanding product portfolio. Ink research details emerge. North Carolina faced competition as Raleigh's Ink Research evaluated where to move its headquarters and add 550 new jobs. Ink Research will receive $8.4 million in JDIG funds over the next 5 years, a total package of $10.6 million with local incentives. As part of the JDIG application, the company had to disclose additional locations it was considering outside the state. That included Cincinnati and Nashville, Tennessee. The estimated value of the incentives was $26.5 million and $13.7 million, respectively, according to the North Carolina Department of Commerce. The total incentives package for Ink Research expanding in Morrisville includes a combined $1.3 million in incentives from the town of Morrisville. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to A Better World, a page written by Todd Cohen, who is also the publisher of Philanthropy North Carolina. We'll start with his column. The headline on his column is, He Preserves the Best of Local History. In the face of growth in Raleigh and Wake County, a boom in land development is putting historic buildings at risk, but also boosting efforts to preserve and restore those properties and integrate them into the region's life and economy. Development creates dangers, but it also creates opportunities, says Gary Roth, president and CEO of Capital Area Preservation in Raleigh. The nonprofit was founded in 1972 as the Mordecai Square Historical Society by individuals who had worked to save Mordecai House after the death of the last descendant of the Mordecai family to live in the house, which dates from the 1700s. In partnership with the City of Raleigh, which renovated the building and maintained it and the grounds, the nonprofit initially managed the visitors program and interpretation of the building. In 1983, the nonprofit accepted its first historic preservation easement, a private agreement with a property owner that is attached to the deed, remains with the property permanently, and includes restrictions on any changes to the building or property unless approved by the party that holds the easement. In 1985, the nonprofit became known as Capital Area Preservation. Operating with an annual budget of $217,000 and a staff of two, the group works to incorporate in our growing future the being the best of the past by protecting historic properties and raising awareness of historic preservation, Roth says. The group now holds 30 easements and often receives a financial gift from the property owner, making the easement to support its easement work. It also serves as staff for the Wake County Historic Preservation Commission, and the number of landmarks approved by municipal and county government since it formed its partnership with Wake in 2003 has grown from 275 from 23. For allowing their property to be designated as a historic landmark, property owners get a 50% deferral on their property tax as long as they comply with the agreement and must seek permission of the commission to make changes to the building exterior or land. If the owners want the designation removed, they must pay 3 years deferred taxes. Capital Area Preservation, which also has contracts with the towns of Apex, Cary, and Mooresville, has developed 5 historic properties since 2003. It typically acquires a property through a gift, then stabilizes and sells it with a preservation easement, often generating a donation from the buyer. Roth says the preservation used to focus on turning the homes of famous Americans into museums. In recent years, the focus has changed to saving buildings to integrate them into the future life of our communities, not to keep them as museums, but to keep them as functioning businesses and homes, he says. We are a growing county, Roth says. We are changing rapidly. It's so important to have a part of our history among us. If a society doesn't have some knowledge or reverence of its history, we march into our future blindly. And now we read the nonprofit news that starts off with the headline, 5 Get Gifts from Ammons Foundation. The Jandy Ammons Foundation is giving $212,011 to help fund capital projects for 5 North Carolina-based nonprofits. Our goal is to seek out those with a strong volunteer base who are planning unique projects to bolster the health and wellness of the community, said Jan Ammons, co-founder and president. They simply need the capital to propel them forward, she says. The grant recipients from 2016 are ChurchNet Foundation of Wake Forest, which needs computer equipment and software, Rex Healthcare Foundation, which will display North Carolina artists' work at the new North Carolina Heart and Vascular Hospital, Raleigh Little Theater, which will use the money for renovations, Wake Forest Historical Museum, which is preserving the old cemetery, NC State Engineering Foundation, which wants to construct a new environmental lab on Centennial Campus. Rise Against Hunger. Raleigh-based global nonprofit Stop Hunger Now, which provides meals to the undernourished, will rebrand as Rise Against Hunger. The nonprofit also recently moved from Hillsborough Street to the Dare Building at 3733 National Drive. Rise Against Hunger is led by President and CEO Rod Brooks. Over the last decade, the organization says cash contributions have increased from $800,000 in 2006 to more than $20 million in 2016. And finally, nonprofit notes. Band Together's annual Last Band Standing will be on February 25 at Lincoln Theater. Band Together is working to support the YMCA of the Triangle this year. Echelon Experiences has named the Interfaith Food Shuttle its core nonprofit partner for 2017. The Interfaith Food Shuttle provides healthy food and culinary information for low-income areas in seven counties. Echelon Experiences is a Raleigh-based restaurant group. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook. And this is written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of Triangle Business Journal. The headline, for retailers, the fix cannot wait any longer. For the past few years, most of my holiday shopping during the last quarter of the year was fulfilled with one push of the order button. I did go to the mall a couple of times in December and bought some stuff. That's probably just like most of you reading this column. But a recent Credit Suisse report puts that consumer behavioral change in perspective. With a market cap nearing $400 billion, Amazon has a value today that is greater than Best Buy, Macy's, Target, JCPenney, Nordstrom, Walmart, Kohl's, and Sears combined, noted Eugene Clerk of Credit Suisse. And that disparity in market value among retailers is likely to continue, even though it is highly doubtful Amazon will be the only player, say, 5 years from now. But for retailers with bricks and mortar stores across all the malls and most of the shopping centers across the triangle, the problem is now. If revenue and margins per store start dwindling and are coupled with lower foot traffic, retailers will close stores regardless of their size or location. Just this month, Macy's announced it will close 68 stores by early spring. Sears informed workers at 78 Kmart and 26 Sears stores that they will be closing in the next 3 months. The JCPenney CEO already has indicated the company would close stores in smaller markets. CVS could trim as many as 70 stores soon. And The Limited closed all of its 250 stores across the country just 3 weeks ago. And there are many more. If that is the reaction from retailers to the current trend, can anyone guess what it would be later, or in the year, or in 2018? More than ever before, price is the commodity driving this consumer change. Amazon offers the same product at a lower price. So a consumer goes to the mall or the shopping center, inspects the product, and then orders it online. Supporting the price theory is the performance of discount retail stores and outlet malls that have managed to improve their margins in the past couple of years. So does that mean the anchor stores and malls will be gone? Not all, but many will be gone soon, especially if they are unable to bridge the Amazon gap. The equation is different for smaller retailers. Boutique stores have been competing with neighboring giant retailers for decades. Their customer base is willing to pay more for better quality. Hence, the Amazon effect is muted. In fact, Amazon offered a new outlet for these sellers to lure new customers who live outside the brick-and-mortar locations. The Best Buys, Macy's, and Targets better come up with an alternate plan. They will not achieve prosperity by cutting. No one ever does. And now we turn to the People on the Move page, and the spotlight in this edition is on Stacy Reedy, Senior Vice President and Chief Financial Officer at North State Bank. An accountant by trade, Stacy Reedy has now stepped into the role of Finance Chief at North State Bank. Reedy joined the bank about 4 years ago as General Auditor and Chief Risk Officer after serving for a half dozen years at a local accounting firm. She takes the role of Chief Financial Officer at North State Bank from the now retired Kirk Wharf. Secession is an ongoing discussion here, Reedy says. I was fortunate enough to work alongside Kirk for the past 12 months as the roles transitioned. Kirk served as a valuable mentor. In her new role, Reedy monitors and measures the bank's interest rates and liquidity and oversees all investment and financial functions. She also works with its president and CEO, Larry Barber, to establish current and long-range goals and strategic initiatives. Raleigh-based North State Bank has $625 million in deposits and a 1.57% market share in the Triangle as of June 30, 2016. According to the Federal Deposit Insurance Group, the bank currently employs 215 people. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? That I don't just sit behind my desk and stare at financials all day. Every day is different and presents unique challenges. I appreciate the variety my job offers and the individuals I interact with daily. What are some of your major goals for your position? To continue the high level this role plays in strategic thinking and planning in order to positively impact the bank. Education, bachelor's and a master's degree from Appalachian State University. Biggest worry? Trying to maintain an integrated life with being a mother, wife, and business professional. As a relatively new mom, this has become even more important to me over the past 18 months. While there is no perfect balance, I strive to be present for my family, friends, and colleagues. Biggest pet peeve? Margins that are not justified and financial tables that do not align. What would you expect from an accountant? Family, husband Nolan, daughter Madison. Last book you've read? Intentional Living, Choosing a Life That Matters by John C. Maxwell. And with our remaining minutes, we'll read some news from around the state. Charlotte weighs tax dollars for MLS bid. For more than 2 hours on January 24, Mecklenburg County commissioners heard from a mix of citizens about the pros and cons of spending $43.75 million of taxpayer money to help pay for a 20,000-seat, $175 million soccer stadium. About 40 people spoke, divided by plenty of strong sentiments on both sides. A couple of speakers, both military veterans, took no stance on the project or its possible funding, but instead used their time before county leaders to demand that any new stadium retain the name American Legion Memorial Stadium. The stadium was built as part of a New Deal program in honor of local World War I veterans. The public hearing followed a whirlwind series of negotiations that started in mid-December when Major League Soccer disclosed plans to add two new teams in late 2017. Bids are due January 31, and Charlotte is among 10 cities selected by the league to compete for the $150 million franchises. The Triangle is also bidding. Marcus Smith, CEO of Speedway Motorsports and son of company founder Bruton Smith, whose personal worth has at times been estimated at more than $1 billion, is leading the Charlotte bid. The Smiths would pay the $150 million entry fee and half the construction cost of the stadium, targeted for a 16-acre county-owned site now occupied by 81-year-old Memorial Stadium and the 3,000-seat Grady Cole Center. The stadium and arena would be demolished and replaced by the proposed MLS venue. Because of the tight deadline, which requires a completed stadium site and funding plan, county and city politicians and administrators spent the past 5 weeks scrambling to find a way to help pay for the stadium. "It's really not something we can do alone," Marcus Smith told commissioners. "We have to have support from the community." Details surfaced last week about possible taxpayer investments in the project. On January 23, City Council heard a presentation about committing a portion of existing tourism taxes for MLS. High Point-based BNC sold to Tennessee firm. High Point-based BNC Bancorp announced January 22 it is being acquired by Pinnacle Financial Partners of Nashville, Tennessee for $1.9 billion in stock. BNC President and CEO Richard Rick Callicutt II will become chairman of the Carolinas and Virginia region once the acquisition is completed. He and three other BNC directors will join Pinnacle's board. The deal is expected to be completed in the third quarter. "Bringing two of the Southeast's best community banks together is a great thing for the region. By joining firms, Pinnacle and BNC can leverage each other's competitive strengths and offer clients a broader array of superior banking services," Callicutt said in a release. BNC, with assets of $7.4 billion, has 76 locations in North Carolina, including the Triangle, South Carolina, and Virginia. Pinnacle, with assets of $11.2 billion, is the second largest bank headquartered in Tennessee. Coastal's Purvis says success begins with listening. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onasorge. Before a crowd heavy with executives, Coastal Federal Credit Union CEO Chuck Purvis was recognized January 20 for his designation by Triangle Business Journal as its 2016 Business Person of the Year. Purvis spoke at a luncheon at Ruth's Chris Steakhouse in North Hills. He said listening, not talking, is what got him to where he is in his career. When joining a company's board of directors, United Way is one of the boards on which he serves. He said they may not hear from him for the first 2 years. By year three, I'm starting to offer ideas around problems that others hadn't thought about, he said. My God-given talent was a curiosity to look at problems in a way others don't. At Coastal, teller efficiency was a big problem when Purvis joined. That's why he helped institute a video teller system, the first in the world, he said. And by deploying tellers more efficiently, he could extend Coastal's branch hours. Whoever thought that, for busy people, banking 8:30 to 5:30 would be convenient, he said, noting that Coastal does 15% of its banking on the weekends. And Coastal isn't just a financial firm, he reminded. Purvis said the credit union is currently planning to launch in the next 60 days a new digital technology company based on patented innovation. We have a pretty robust online and mobile tablet banking platform market today that we get from a large technology company, he said. Getting them to take our ideas and innovate them into the software is either very expensive or very hard, so about every 3 or 4 years we have to do a new one. That's where Coastal's new patented technology comes in, a platform that instead of cramming everything into one offering, acts like an app store. We wanted to make multiple apps available to our members, Purvis said. We're building a company to create a technology framework that will allow us to take apps with anyone, put them in a store that their users can use when they need it. And Coastal continues to be in expansion mode, seeking out new branch locales from Durham to Knightdale. In his speech, Purvis began by thanking his wife of 32 years, Gail. And as our time winds down, the last thing we'll mention is the Business Survey Pulse. The question was, would the repeal of Obamacare help or hurt North Carolina businesses? There were 298 responses. Of those responses, 46% said it would help business, 34% said it would hurt business, and 20% say it's too soon to say. And we'll stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.